everybody, to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Happy Eve of Thanksgiving. I have many things to be grateful for. Of course, you listeners and readers, writers, books, my cats, my friends, my family, and my guests. Before we get going, speaking of being gratified for books and grateful for books, I want to just tell you who released books this week. J.R. Backlund, Down the Broken Road, Claire Fullerton, Morning Dove, Gavin Reese, The Absolver, Rome, Eve Wing, Chasing Rainbows, NYC, Regan Black's Dylan from the Guardian Angels, Tim Hallin's Nighttown, You Can't Miss It, Junior Bender's new one, Bo Johnson, The Big Machine Eats, and my guest today, Monk Yoon Ro. He has a book called Mad Monk Manifesto. Monk is a Taoist monk who was ordained, I think ordained is the right word, in China. We're going to learn more about him and his beautiful, fabulous, wonderful Tao philosophy of life. Monk Yoon Ro, thank you so much for being with me. Welcome to Authors on the Air.
Thank you so much for having me and for taking all that trouble to get my name right.
I have it written down in front of me phonetically because I am a blonde Polish girl who was probably born at night, may or may not have been aliens or gypsies involved, so I write it all down.
Well, thank goodness you do and that people read what we all write, yes?
There you go. Monk, I want to say to you, our conversation in the green room has motivated me to look for more books such as yours. The title of your book, Mad Monk Manifesto, I said to you, I thought you had a great sense of humor, as well as writing about some really valuable, I don't want to say a principle, but I think guides for mindfulness in our life. Would that be an accurate way to describe this book?
Mindfulness, you know, has gotten a little bit of a bad rap just lately on account of how widespread and commercialized it has become. So I think let us say that mindfulness is always the first step in any kind of awakened thinking, any kind of deep thinking. So since we're on that subject, let me say that the very, very first step in any kind of transformational effort, in any kind of spiritual pursuit or path, must always be the quiet recognition that something is going on. So whether you're out on a boat and you turn off the engine and you just notice the waves and the wind and the sky, the current, whether you're taking a walk in a park and come to a quiet place and just watch the way the wind blows the leaves and the squirrels scamper around, whatever it is, just noticing that something is going on is a profound, profound thing to do. And it sounds trite and it's simple. And on some level, it is simple. And yet, if you really recognize that there is some process, something moving us all forward, and that it is much larger than we are, and it will be here when we are not, this is the very, very first step to any kind of other deep work.
You describe this as an awakening, and I wonder if this is something that you experience still every day, because as I grow older and hopefully a little bit wiser, I find myself in deeper contemplation of things than ever had before.
I don't think that there is a better reason to write than to give ourselves an excuse to think deeply about things. So I would like to think that yes, I do that every day.
I I oftentimes, especially recently, find myself so overwhelmed with, I love what I do. I want to qualify this statement. I love interacting with writers and readers and listeners and attending book conferences and trying to open myself up to more writers and genres and so on. But I find myself a little overwhelmed at times, and I want to say, I need Pam time. Just Pam time. I've just always called it that. And at those times, sometimes I just sit really quietly. More and more and more, I seem to be needing a change. Does it sound like I'm getting anywhere close to having an awakening?
An awakening is not a switch, even though certain stories and mythologies would have us believe it is. It's a process. It doesn't happen overnight for anyone, not even the Buddha, who famously sat underneath the Bodhi tree, you know, for night after night after night, warding off the temptations of the god Mara. I don't think that anybody wakes up all at once. And quite frankly, if you think about waking up all at once, then your mind will right away go to there's a gunshot outside your window, or your alarm very loud suddenly goes off when you're deep in sleep. Or there's your dog starts barking like crazy at 3 a.m, you know, or there's a siren outside the window, or your smoke alarm goes off, or your burglar alarm goes off. Things that stimulate a very rapid awakening when we are in sleep are traumatic and unpleasant, and we wouldn't tie them to any kind of higher consciousness. You know, they're accompanied by a squeeze of adrenaline, our heart pumps, we feel vaguely nauseated later, sometimes we get a headache, and we have trouble going back to sleep. So I think we could just once and for all dispense with the idea of a one-step instant awakening. I think that that may have happened to some people I call cork poppers, right? It's a sense that the cork, you know, stuck in the top of their head popped off and they were suddenly enlightened. But even those people, whether that was Buddha or Jesus or Muhammad or Lao Tzu or Zhuangzi or, you know, any myriad other great sages, whether that happened really the way we've just been describing as a gunshot kind of thing, I don't believe so.
It's always a very slow, sometimes very subconscious thing that happens.
It's subtle.
Yes. It's interesting that when you were talking about the things that wake you up suddenly, and immediately my mind went to trauma. It's a horrible way to wake up. I think it's a terrible way to wake up, actually, and it's hard on your system, your psyche, and your physical being as well. Can you please tell me, the audience, a little bit about how you became a Tao monk? I'm very curious about this.
So in the same way that we just qualified awakening, in the context of your question about whether you were on the right path or getting there in some way, and we qualified it by agreeing that it was a subtle business.
But yes.
It's not just the process of awakening that's a subtle business. It's also the state of being awakened is a subtle business. All it means, I can't remember if it was one of the Suzukis who said, that I think Alan Watts quotes him as saying that, you know, enlightenment, before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood and carry water, which is an old Zen saw. And then Suzuki added, except for 2 inches above the ground. So I always like that description. But I think that tracing an awareness and a perception of the subtle things that unite everything and run through all that is itself a subtle business. And subtle is a great word for all of this. And so in answer to your question about becoming a monk, you know, I've been asked this a lot lately in interviews, and I think that the best answer is that it was and remains a subtle process. I mean, yes, there was a period where I was technically officially, you know, the Chinese government and all that. But but the process began, you know, in childhood, being a seeker, you know, born a seeker, maybe being born into a Holocaust survivor family, feeling like the answers and explanations and rationales for all kinds of things were presented to me about all kinds of things, ranging from politics and work and identity and religion and society and wealth and health and all these other things. I wasn't satisfied with the answers I got. And I was always looking, and my mother, who was a philosophy major and a student of Martin Buber, the famous Jewish philosopher, had a library full of philosophy books, including some Taoist and Buddhist texts. And so even as a 12-year-old or 10-year-old, I gravitated toward them with a sense that there was something there for me. There was something there, A, and that there was something there for me, B. And of course, you know, a lot of famous texts, particularly in the Taoist canon, but also in the Buddhist canon, are themselves the subject of great scholarly difference. And so people study them for ages, for a lifetime, without being entirely certain they understand their meaning. And I can promise you that I didn't understand any of it when I was 10 or 12 years old. Nonetheless, you know, I just had some subconscious drive in that direction. So, you know, it manifested first through studying martial arts. I used to get beaten up a lot as a kid. You know, New York City, where I grew up, was a rough place back then, and I used to get mugged regularly, and I wasn't bullied, but I was mugged. And you know, I felt like I wanted to be able to handle myself. So after a particularly rough episode in South America where I was incarcerated for saving a woman from a beating by a drunken policeman on the street.
Oh, my God.
You know, I felt that's a story for another day. But I felt
yes.
like, and there were some other similarly traumatic, you know, episodes in my young life, probably, you know, a sign of my defective character. I couldn't mind my own business. Nonetheless, you know, I decided that it would be good to handle myself, to learn how to be able to handle myself. So, but you know, the path formally began in the martial arts and went on from there. After a certain level of that, it all becomes, you know, you become aware that violence is the lowest common denominator of human interaction, and all this fuss about cage fighting and gladiatorial things, it is a very low level of human experience. And beyond that, you know, the martial arts become a gateway to more interesting things.
I have friends that have been studying their lifetime Tai Chi and find that that is a very effective way to keep their mind, body, and spirit intact, but it's a very good defensive movement as well. You reminded me of that when you talked about rescuing a woman who is being beaten by someone. I had a demonstration of it at a conference one time. I was very impressed with it. It's a very graceful, but also a very defensive type of a movement, is it not?
Tai Chi, a lot of people who study it as a consequence of New Age influences and how popular it has become of late in the U.S., many people had no idea that it's a martial art. It was, in fact, originally a battlefield martial art. So it was not intended, you know, to help us defend ourselves on the street against an assailant. It was meant for horseback battle with, you know, long weapons, 12-foot spears and 7-foot halberds that weighed, you know, 100 pounds and,
wow.
You know, against armored opponents and so on. So I wouldn't say that it is a practical, its primary strength, even the modern iteration, is not as a quick, you know, quick fix kind of self-defense art. There are better things for that. If all you want to do is, you know, learn how to handle yourself in a bar fight in the shortest possible time. If somebody comes to me and says, look, I'm shipping out to Afghanistan in 6 weeks, and I don't want to die. I don't try to teach them Tai Chi. I teach them meditation and then send them to a purveyor of Krav Maga or Russian Sistema or one of these, you know, very streetable, quick to learn kind of thing. Tai Chi is the physical manifestation of Taoist philosophy. It was concocted on a tripod of that philosophy, Chinese medicine, so that you understand how the body works and energy flows, and the effective existing martial arts of the day. So, you know, that tripod takes a great deal of time to master. It's a fractal, which means that it has the same intelligence and design at every level of scale. So you could spend, you know, theoretically, you could spend 40 years learning one move or just doing Taoist standing meditation, which is part of Tai Chi practice. And you could become a Tai Chi master by learning only one move if you fully understood all the aspects and elements that were involved in that move. It's a tantalizing, maddeningly difficult, absolutely gorgeous and addictive and engaging pursuit. But I wouldn't recommend it, for a fast track to self-defense.
Interesting. Let's talk about
top masters, of course, are very competent, but not most of us.
I'd like to talk about Mad Monk Manifesto, please. The subtitle of this is A Prescription for Evolution, Revolution, and Global Awakening. What was your intention when you wrote this book?
We are at a point where we have a choice. Evolution is much more like fireworks than it is like a railroad line. It is full of attempts and events, the great majority of which fail and are lost to oblivion. We are now on a course which is not sustainable, and we will not survive it, nor will the rest of the sentient beings on planet Earth. And we have a choice. We either make a course correction because we are uniquely in the history of evolution suited and able to do so, or we don't. And that course correction has to be a change in how we see ourselves, each other, and the rest of the world. And this book is a modest attempt to try to kickstart or provide a primer for what such an evolutionary right turn might look like.
Interesting. Let's talk about there are very few chapters in this book, but they are hugely important. And while the book is about, well, let me tell you exactly how many pages I have right in front of me. It's 270 pages in the edition that I have. The first part of it talks about finding answers. What does that mean to you? And what should it mean to me?
You mean the introduction?
Well, yeah, finding answers, discover venerated wisdom, improve yourself and the world, and learn something new. These are the kind of the tenets set out by you in this book.
So I think, you know, when you look at the way people are suffering now, as evidenced and expressed by rising rates of suicide, rising violence, a choice to disappear into video games or social media, the forthcoming and burgeoning industry of virtual reality, which will make everything from adventure games to sex games more real and palpable and interesting than most of the lives that the average person leads. You see that if you look at all those choices and you understand the suffering that is under it, you realize that there are basic needs that are not being met. in our society, the need for touch, the need for community, the need for recognition, the need for approbation and appreciation, the need for companionship, and so on. And when those needs are missing, you know, we become, as you see us to be by looking at the news every day. So when we talk about finding answers, we're looking to find specific tactics and ways of reframing who we think we are, what we think we deserve, and to what and to whom we belong. It's a very step-by-step notion that if we can find those sores and heal them, we will be cultivating ourselves. And by cultivating ourselves, we act as if we are a stone dropped into a pond, and the radiating waves go out all the way to our family, our community, our city or town, and eventually our country and our world. And they touch, those waves, everything from politics to art to environment and to other, you know, other sentient beings on the planet. So, you know, the Taoist idea is we quote unquote fix ourselves. The real word is cultivate ourselves. And in doing so, we do the same for the world.
I was reading a little bit about Taoism before you and I began to speak. And one of the, I think what is called, just an overview that, this is what I read, and you'll tell me if this is right. Understanding the nature of reality, increasing longevity, ordering life morally, practicing rulership, regulating consciousness and diet. I understand all but practicing rulership. What does that mean to you?
So the first, I want to just make a tweak to the thing you read and say that instead of understanding reality, or the nature of reality, I would say it's more about understanding the reality of nature. I would turn
that around. And I kind of got that, but yes, I think that's worded incorrectly. I was very curious about practicing rulership, because, and I don't know if that means ownership of self and ownership of actions. I'm not really sure how to interpret that.
Yeah, so I love this question because it's very timely, among other things, and interesting. There is a chapter in the Tao Te Ching, which is our one of our primary texts in the canon, by Lao Tzu, right? This is the second, I'm told, I don't know if this is true, but it's a widely bandied about statistic that it is the second most widely translated book in the world after the Judeo-Christian Bible. It's significantly more or less verbose, and it's only 5,000 characters and a few more words than that. But in one stanza, it was originally thought to have been a tone poem or a song. One stanza talks about leadership, and it talks about rulers. And it is based on that stanza, as well as some other cues, that we think that the Tao Te Ching may have been written as a manual for the emperor of China on how to rule his country and interact with his subjects. So whether or not that's true, the stanza does make the point that the worst ruler is the one that everyone hates. Slightly better is the one that everyone fears. Slightly better is the one that everyone loves. But best of all is the ruler nobody knows.
It's interesting.
So the idea that someone in power, and you can take that whether we're talking about the U.S. presidency or we're talking about the head of a corporation, the head of a household, or anything else, the one in power should strive to be the kind of manager and leader who so nurtures and stewards the unfolding of all beneath him or her that everybody thinks that they're doing all the good stuff themselves, And nobody ever thinks that the ruler is manipulating or forcing or setting any kind of tone. Again, we're back to that wonderful word, subtle. So really
yes.
good leadership is so subtle that in the ideal world, we wouldn't really know who was in the White House, but we would just notice that the country was doing really well. And so were we all individually.
What a beautiful thought. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Yeah.
I like that. I'm going to keep that in mind for a lot of things. Let's talk a little bit more about your book. What is our role as keepers in nature and how nature keeps us?
So there are two, you know, quick primary subjects here. One is the worldview that has been given us in the Judeo-Christian tradition that planet Earth and its inhabitants are here for us. They are here for our pleasure. This is our sandbox to do with as we wish. We can crap it up or we can regard it as sacred. All of that is up to us. And the fate and the life and the suffering of all the other sentient creatures on planet Earth are entirely our business, and to be, and we are the agency of life and death and all the rest. That idea is relatively unique in the religious world and does not exist in Taoism at all. And it has been, in my view, and the view of other people, the root of a lot of the environmental disasters that we see unfolding in the state of our planet now. And it is largely an unconscious sense that, you know, we are the top of the heap and everything else is below us and therefore not so important. And some of this is not all to be blamed on the Abrahamic faiths. It also can be attributed to the rise in humanism, which is another, you know, sort of evolutionary stage in the human experience. But so one thing is to question that and to recognize that we are all one thing. So this is the second point, that the distinction between a human and a chimpanzee or a dog, or even in this context, a worm, is a distinction that exists in our heads. It's between our ears, like our gods. We create these things in order to justify or explain our behaviors and often our excesses. So, you know, mythologies and legends are great and we all love them. I write them and read them. And, you know, we're on a podcast or a show now about telling stories and writing books. So, you know, there is no greater fan than I of this kind of thing. But when we start to mistake those things for reality and we don't see them as wonderful lessons and useful anymore, then we get confused and we lose actual truth of things, which is that the same fingers motivate every glove. Every glove on Earth, whether it's a bacterium or a Pam or a monk, is motivated by that, by this undercurrent we call Tao. We have other words too. And if we see the non-dual nature of everything, if we see us as all part, at the risk of mixing the metaphor of the same tapestry, or again, motivated by the same sort of celestial hand that comes in and out, we're born, we move around, the hand withdraws, the glove goes back to the earth, and then the hand goes into another glove. But if we understand things from this point of view, we realize that how we behave towards each other and all living things and our home, this earth, makes a great deal of difference. And we all are part of the same thing. That unity, that union of view, is a very important thing in Taoist thought.
It's lovely to hear you speak like this. I'm a firm believer that the earth was not put here for us. So you've kind of confirmed what I've always thought. What is our role as individuals to each other?
Once we have done the process that I outline in Mad Monk Manifesto as the rectification of ourselves. Once we have set the wounds to healing and set the rest of us to growing, then we are in the right place to engage in relationships that are meaningful, guided by behaviors that we know are right and true. And of course, this doesn't only obtain when you're talking about interpersonal relationships, but it also obtains when we're talking about how we are as a nation, how we are politically, how we are in the world at large, how we are with other sentient creatures. If we feel that we are doing something wrong, something that is wrong in the light of an awakened mind, and that wrong thing is legal or required by a government or a ruler or a system, if we really, really feel that it is wrong with a capital R, then it is our duty to exercise civil disobedience and not do it.
Interesting.
So that's why revolution is in my title.
Wait, I have just a few minutes left, and I've already really overstayed my welcome with you, and I'm sorry to do that, but I think it's important that for me to note that you also have written thrillers and other kinds of books under your former name before you became a Taoist monk. Would you care to speak to that for a few minutes?
Sure. I had early success as a writer of crime fiction. I was always uncomfortable with my place or the invitation to a place in the New York publishing club, the place I was raised up and was an Ivy League literature major and had, well-connected teachers and editors and so on. And I became... I felt like the Groucho Marx quote about not wanting to be a member of any club that would have me.
Would have you, right?
I was concerned that there was a really narcissistic quality to fiction writing in that time and in that place, and I felt like somehow storytelling and writing ought to be serving some kind of less egoic and not and higher reason for being. I'm not sure what the word I want here is, but I felt like there ought to be a deeper and a higher reason for writing and for telling story than to have people recognize you at cocktail parties and applaud what you do. And I always warred with myself about this. And in my early career of writing crime novels, I had some not totally insignificant success, and I found that I didn't like myself very much doing that because I felt that was kind of selling out. So when I finally came to the marriage of my Taoist philosophy and my interest in spirituality, I found a whole new world of things to write about, not just nonfiction like the Manifesto, but also novels of Chinese history and philosophy and martial arts and culture. And I wrote them in what I hope you will find and the readers or listeners will find with a literary sensibility. And my typical formula is to do one chapter in the old times, one chapter in the new times, and to run sort of parallel stories that intertwine with energy and philosophy and ideas. And I have more of those coming out even from the same publisher as the Manifesto in the next year or two.
I think it's wonderful that you've written so many different things. And as you've changed and grown and become aware and so on, your writing has changed with it. May I just ask for you to, I know what it is, but I'm going to ask anyway, what rune Yun Ro means?
Yes. There's a bit of a complex story, which we don't have time for, but let me just say that in the Taoist tradition, to move in an unfettered and natural way with as little effort as possible is a celebrated thing. And for that reason, the name Yunro, which means soft cloud, is a beautiful Taoist name, and I'm very lucky to have it.
Do you take your own Taoist name, or are you ordained with it by someone else?
Oh, no. So, complex story, again, because I have two Taoist lineages and I have two Taoist names, but I don't use the other one because I like this one better. So, I was given it by my master in recognition of things he saw in me, for which I'm very grateful.
How lovely. I think I like that very much. Before we go, Monk, would you please tell listeners what you hope they get from Mad Monk Manifesto?
Comfort, reassurance, inspiration, and a good companion to carry around in your purse or backpack for a while to come.
It's a really nice thing. Would you please share your web address and your Twitter address, please?
Sure. I am. My website is Monk Yunro. That's M-O-N-K Y-U-N-R-O-U.com. By the way, you can also find me through another URL, which leads to my site, which some people might find easier, and that is Play Tai Chi.
Very good.
.com, you know, I got a while back, and it's a nice one. And on Twitter, I am at Monk Yunro. Again, it's M-O-N-K-Y-U-N-R-O-U. And there is a Mad Monk Manifesto Facebook page, too.
I cannot tell you how honored I am and what a pleasure it's been to listen to you speak today. I hope that you'll come back and when I can spend some more time with you and we can have a real great spiritual and philosophical discussion about these things. Will you please come back?
I will, and you won me over by putting me in such august company in our brief conversation before the show, and you have my gratitude, and you can have me anytime you want.
Thank you. And just for those of you who are fans of people like Brother Thomas Merton, you know, I speak about him often, Eckhart Tolle, Alan Watts, even Dr. Wayne Dyer, the late Dr. Wayne Dyer. If you enjoy reading the reflections by these gentlemen, you will certainly appreciate Monk Yunro. Thank you so much, sir. And I wish you a wonderful day. And I appreciate everything
you said.
Thank you,
Pam, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you, and to yours as well. All righty. And that's my show for right now, folks. I'll be back at 6 o'clock. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. See you later.